It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
I'm talking to Pam Marone, and she has a company called Bio Innovations, and it's an interesting area, and I think a more important area. Pam, it's kind of hard to explain, I think, to the average person. I've got mm-hmm. farmers, I've got consumers. You run into somebody at a party or the coffee shop, and they say, tell me what you do. What's your, not even an elevator speech, so this is like a coffee shop speech, but how do you explain what you do?
Well, you know how drug companies have gone hunting in the rainforest looking for new drugs?
Sure.
And aspirin originally came from willow bark, or your antibiotics come from microbes. We do exactly the same thing. We go hunting in the rainforest or hunting in an organic soil, looking for microbes and plants that can be turned into products that control pests and increase crop growth. And we can do it safely, and the products are very safe, and they don't harm pollinators and don't harm people.
That's a pretty good explanation. Now, let me go back then one more thing. What's desirable about that is not only a question of yield, but you don't have to be worrying about the things people fear in pesticide contamination or using petrochemicals and producing carbon and then the production of the materials that you're finding. So you're affecting either, you know, production or prevention of loss to pests.
Right.
From this natural inquiries and
That's
journeys
right.
that you're on.
That's right. So, yeah, the products are natural and then naturally made. They're either extracted from a plant or fermented. You touched on something very interestingly. Today, it's all about carbon footprint. And
sure.
A lot of big companies, most of them, the food companies and so forth, and every company, in fact, is worried about their sustainability. And indeed, because our products are based on fermentation and extracting from plants and their natural materials, we just did a study that showed they did have a lower carbon footprint than petrochemical-based chemical synthetic pesticides.
It's so confusing. I mean, everybody knows that they're paying attention to climate change, although depending on your political leanings, you may need to call it something else, you know, or I don't know, global warming, weather change, whatever, but it's climate change. And they're looking at carbon sequestration.
Right.
So you get the carbon, and it's getting into the plant, and it's getting in the ground, it's staying there. Or you get greenhouse gas emissions, which include carbon and include methane and nitrous oxide. Is that the three main greenhouse?
That's one of them, yeah. That's one of them,
major greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. And so what you're finding, say, for example, what do you find in soils that could be useful, that could be either carbon friendly or solving some of the problems that we need in farming when you go look into soil?
Well, you know, soils have been hardly explored for this purpose. So in all the companies that I've started, we've looked at, which we've isolated, which means we've taken a sample of soil or parts of plants or compost, and we've looked for the microbes that live in there. And so I've probably over my career isolated in my groups have screened, what would be screened or discovered, 250,000 different microbes. And in nature, you start seeing some patterns. Okay, so what's there? Like, for example, from a dry creek bed, we find things that are really good for controlling plant diseases. From under a conifer tree or from rotting wood, we often find things that are good for insect control. So, and isolating from flowers and from leaves, it's very good at warding off plant diseases. So there are patterns in nature, and we over time see those patterns and then are able to turn those into products that farmers can use.
You identified 250,000 what?
Microorganisms over my career. Over my career. So that would be bacteria, molds or fungi. Fungi are called molds. And there's a third group called actinomycetes. Most of your antibiotics are from actinomycetes. So we find these things and then we test them in the laboratory against pests and plant diseases, and also look at what their effect is on crop growth. Do they boost crop growth? And so we find that it's just amazing what's out there, and there's you can find a microbe to do just about anything. So
we could go out and stick a spade in the ground.
Yes.
And we would find thousands of varieties of microbes.
Well, you'd actually probably find billions.
Billions.
But the thing is, I send you out on a random collection, like go out, like you said, I can send you out right here, dig up some soil and bring it back to the laboratory, and you might find something. But that's like looking for a needle in a haystack. What we look for are the patterns in nature. So for example, farmers sometimes say that some parts of the field, they never have any diseases or pests.
Right.
Other parts of the field, they have a problem. So what I would do is I'd go to that part of the field where they never have any plant diseases, and I'd take a soil sample, and we would isolate what's in there. And more than likely, that would give us a chance to find something that could be developed to a biological pesticide.
So that's just incredible to me that when I hear you talk about this, and I've heard others too, it's such a mystery. I mean, there is so much under our feet, literally.
That's right.
That affects us in ways we haven't even begun to figure out.
That's right. And there's a organic farming is based on having a healthy soil. Healthy soil means healthy plants and a better crop. And now that healthy soil initiative is being applied to conventional farmers, and that is great because that means they're going to, you know, have a healthier soil, maybe be able to use less fertilizer and then have less runoff, nitrate runoff and phosphate runoff and less pollution and so forth. But what I've learned in studying this whole area and being in it is that we're still at the very early stages of understanding what's going on beneath our feet. For example, I've seen some studies of people characterizing the microbes in a farm where they've irrigated and then there's no irrigation, and the microbes are vastly different. And so what is just one part of the farm is different from another part of the farm. So there's a lot of attention of trying to demystify what's going on, but let's say we're just at the early stages of a very exciting time. Well, whereas more than 50% of your human drugs are derived from natural sources, natural products, microbes and extracts of plants, only 15% of pesticides are derived from natural products. So we have a long way to go.
You know, when you were talking about going to different areas and seeing different microbe level and at different areas, it made me think about how above ground there's a difference in the nutritional value of plants depending on how hard the plant is stressed.
That's right.
And that when a plant has to work harder, sometimes you're getting the benefit of that strength in the fruit or the vegetable.
Right.
Now, so what makes me wonder is the same thing happen underground.
It does. The same thing happens with microbes. We can prove this, actually. We can take a microbe and ferment it, and you can stress it, and it will change the types of compounds that it produces. So we have one microbe that was discovered from a Buddhist temple garden in Japan, and we can change how we grow it, and it can produce compounds that kill insects or nematodes, but then we can ferment it a completely different process and food, a different recipe, and it will produce something that kills weeds. Remarkable. So microbes have this ability to be able to do different things depending on how they're grown and the stress they're under. If you make it fat and happy, and you give it this food that gives it everything it needs, then it doesn't produce any of these pesticidal compounds because it doesn't need to.
You know, I was just thinking that if you could go back like 3,000 years, there must have been a time where people were saying, look at this yellow powder. What is this yellow stuff on the rocks? Turned out to be gold.
That's right.
And you know, you're kind of at that same thing. You're coming across stuff that has miraculous effect. And like I say, I'm finding some for human health, but you can find it for plant health. It just makes sense that you
sure,
should.
Sure, it does. And so now a lot of big money's discovered this. So you've got venture capitalists and Silicon Valley discovering and Boston-based venture capital people discovering this area and putting literally billions of dollars into this area. But there's still a lot more to learn about how nature works, and but step by step we're unraveling it.
So if you get in there, we go dig that spade in, and you get this whole process where you've identified 250,000 different kind of microbes, and I mean, these are little critters.
So, they are. Microscopic, yeah.
So if you've got this microscopic, how do you propagate them? How do you take that and turn it into a lot of those little critters?
So the first step would be to put it on let it grow on a petri plate, which is a solid agar, like a gel-like substance, and then you transfer it from that gel into
a liquid recipe. And so you grow it in a liquid form. Mm-hmm. And so just like you're making wine and beer, so when you make wine and beer, there's yeasts in there that are growing and turning the grape or the hops into your beer and your wine. Same process we use, except it's faster. So ours are more from 36 hours to 72 hour process. So you put the microbe in a vat. It could be a vessel. Mm-hmm. So it could be stainless steel vessel. And in our manufacturing, they might be three stories tall. In the laboratory in Davis, it would be maybe a quart size or a gallon size or 5 gallon size. And so you actually put food in there, which would be in a liquid form, water, and the food recipe, like you're making a cake. And then you put
stuff that likes to eat.
Yep, stuff that likes to eat. Then you put the bacteria in there, and then it's because there's food in there for it, it starts replicating itself. And it grows and grows, and so it keeps growing and replicating, reproducing itself. And then after, as I said, anywhere from 36 to 72 hours, depending on the microbe, it eats up all that food, and then it's done. And it's sort of like you're not going to get any more of its growth, and then you harvest it. So you take the whole broth, the whole soup, and our products can be that whole soup. And then you have to add preservatives, and we use only natural food grade organic things to make it be a preserve it, because if you don't stop if you don't put something in there, you'll get contamination. So you put it in there, and then it goes in a jug. And then
usually liquid or
it depends on the microbe. So we do both powders and dry it like you're making powdered milk. Or just a liquid, and it depends on the microbes. So sometimes the microbe's not stable enough in a liquid form, and we have to dry it. And then it's without taking the water out, it's like it's in a suspended state, and so it lasts longer. So it depends on the microbe. We have products that are either powders or liquids.
So it goes out to a farmer.
Yep.
Give us a product. For example, I don't know what it would be, some vegetable or fruit or something. Where's the application stage that you take that and get it into the crop production?
So it's the whole way. So we have, let's take venerate. So venerate is a new species of bacteria we discovered from that soil in a garden near a Buddhist temple in Japan. And we actually can coat the seeds with it, and it will help the stave off the growing, the germinating seed from maggots and other wireworms and rootworms and other things that are affecting nematodes, which are roundworms that feed on the roots of plants in the soil. So you're protecting it right when it's germinating. Then we can apply it once the plant is up. Yeah. And you could stop the...
That's like spraying
them? Yeah, you spray it right on the crop, and it'll stop the insects and mites from developing. So just and so spray it on, so it can be both in the ground as well as on top.
Many people have heard of BT.
Right.
It's been somewhat controversial because it was involved in genetic engineering.
That's right. The natural BT is still the largest biopesticide, and it's still used on millions of acres of crops in the United States.
Yeah, and organic too, right?
Absolutely.
Organic.
In fact, I was visiting some growers today in this Monterey County area, and they were still using BT because they had worms in their leafy greens.
Oh, wow.
And cabbages. So, you know.
This just makes so much sense. So it sounds like there is a gold mine. It's under our feet. I'm still thinking back of you finding something in a temple in Japan, for crying out loud.
Well, we've also found something from a cinnamon tree in the Honduran rainforest, from under conifers in Maryland, from a rice field in Northern California, from a beach in Hawaii. So,
well, you know what I wondered about is some of these really, really old cemeteries, because if you get back into the eastern United States, they still have native grasses in some of these little small rural areas.
They do.
And nothing has ever happened to them. So you see somebody that was buried in 1830, and all around them, the ground cover is not too much different than it was in 1830.
Well, you know, funny you should say that, because I grew up in a little town in Killingworth, Connecticut, and Connecticut's an old state, original state. And there's a cemetery with the original founders of the town from the 1700s and 1800s, and I have collected samples from that cemetery. Funny, and I always notice that the plants and the lichens are very different and bizarre in that cemetery than I've ever seen before. And I have to go back and check with the lab and see if they've found any interesting things from there.
Well, the one thing I've been telling some other people I've mentioned, but if I go back east and I notice things like the carrots are more orange, they're like grown the same way with the same variety, and ours are a little bit more yellow-orange, and they're a little like almost reddish-orange. You know that almost everything about it is the same varieties, it's just different soils.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Yep.
So, the other thing then, and we admit that there's just a tremendous world down there that we can still be kind of harvesting and applying, and like you were saying, it's safe, it doesn't deal with residues, and,
right.
And so...
Pests don't develop resistance, yeah.
Now, one thing that everybody's talking about soils now and soil improvement.
Right, Healthy Soil Initiative, yeah.
Yeah, and it's in California. I think other places are doing it,
yep,
too.
Yep.
One of the things I think that I wonder if we're not taking a leap, because a lot of people are saying healthy soils, healthy food, and yet I don't see a lot of data. There's been an awful lot of research done on nutrition, but I don't see a lot backing up the claims that the healthy soils have a nutritional impact. And I don't doubt
no,
that
you're
it's
right.
true.
No, you're right. It's assumed that based on, decades of farmers who have had healthier and more diverse soil, that you're going to have healthier food. But I would say you're right. Has nutritional studies been done on the crops grown, the produce grown in a healthy or non-healthy soil? It's intuitive, but you're right. I haven't actually seen the data.
I really feel like that's a missing link.
I think you're right. It's probably true.
And I think that it doesn't seem like it'd be that hard. It costs money, though. I suppose it's always one of the issues is that when you've got a potential product that can have this implication, but it's hard to commercialize it and say you're going to make a lot of money out of it, that you're going to package things grown that way.
Yeah.
There's
other benefits. So I was out on a farm tour yesterday here from the EcoFarm conference, and they gave us a poster on the Healthy Soils Initiative done by California Department of Food and Ag, and it was more about there was a lot more. It was also about preventing nitrate runoff, preventing pollution, using less water, less greenhouse gas emission. So it was not just about, is my plant more nutritious? In fact, that wasn't even mentioned. It was more about the effects on the environment.
So say, for example, let's go to carbon sequestration. So if the carbon is getting kind of into the soil, and then your minimum till, no-till,
cropping.
All these other things, cover cropping and so forth, that environment it creates for the microbes, is it optimized by your success in getting more carbon sequestered in the soil?
Yes. So microbes like that, then you get typically you'd see a higher biodiversity of microbes in that condition. Yeah.
And that
helps the not only the soil but also it should help the plant.
It's amazing because around the country everybody knows like who are the best farmers and getting so many bushels an acre else. But it'd be interesting if you could almost look at soils like that and be measurements and
that's
saying
true.
Okay, this is we're producing this much more of the healthy microbes because of these practices.
Well, there are companies trying to do that. There's two that I know of. One is called Trace Genomics and the other one called Biome Makers. And both of those companies are trying to characterize farmers' soils and show why one soil is healthier than the other. Good luck to them because I know they're in beta testing right now because it would be very interesting to see how that works.
We have an equivalent for humans in the people that are buying probiotics.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And so there's more and more work on gut health.
That's right.
And people buying, I know firsthand that it costs $3.75 to get my favorite probiotic beverage from Costco or somewhere. So they're kind of pricey, but there's other people that like me that I like the taste and think it's probably good. And rather not have to be spending as much money to have refrigerated so many billions of,
sure.
In your refrigerator in pill form. as we see what you're doing on the production level, mm-hmm. and we see that with probiotics and the increasing interest in gut health
yep.
on the human level, are there opportunities to connect those dots?
That's a very good question. So I would suspect so. There's studies coming out that what you eat definitely changes your microbiome. So that makes sense that what's on the plant or the microbes associated with the plant would have something to do with that. But I haven't seen any specific studies on them. But there's obviously studies that show that if you eat a plant-based diet versus a meat-based diet, and the nutrition of your diet changes your microbiome. But I don't know how that correlates into the actual microbiome on the plant.
Or consuming antibiotics, whether it's in the foods that you're eating or taking too much antibiotics, that it's not good for your gut health.
That's right. That's known. That's definitely known.
Ironic, though, you pointed out that microbes are used to produce antibiotics.
Yes,
so in a healthy
true.
Soil,
that's
I think
true.
That they'd be neutralizing some sort of weird effects there, too. You've got those microbes that are...
There are microbes that are at war with each other, producing antibiotics and preventing and keeping their competitors at bay. That's true. That's very true.
You know what? If you look down the road and continue to see progress in this area, what does that look like to you? I mean, if you're going to say, okay, we're into something here, this is important, what does a better world look like that's maximizing, you know, what we can learn and how we can apply microbes in this?
So right now we have a chemical intensive agriculture for the most part, and that means that farmers, unless they're organic, let's put the organic ones aside. So a conventional farmer typically uses chemicals back to back in their programs and then dials in a biological, a microbe or a plant extract when they don't have a chemical solution or their chemical solution fails. Over time, what we're going to see is that we're going to go from the chemical era to the biological era, and that means that the base of the program will be biological, and then you'll only dial in the chemicals as needed. We're on that continuum. We're not there yet, but over the next 10 years, we'll probably be much further up on that continuum.
There's a controversy currently about whether organic is real organic or not. And there's a concern
that
the ones that are soil-based feel like the ones that are hydroponic don't belong there. And it's because they feel like it needs to be, the whole idea behind organic was to be...
It's the healthy soil.
But I'm wondering down the road, someday you'll be adding a lot of those components of the healthy soil maybe into that world that's a substrate and it's actually... perhaps is in a greenhouse.
Yeah, I understand and I empathize with those who think that a hydroponic system shouldn't be organic, but at the same time, wouldn't you want to have hydroponic growers use organic practices other organic growers instead of, you know, having the total thing using toxic chemicals? So sometimes you have to be pragmatic about these things. And I'd like to see that transition go on regardless of whether they're, you know, certified organic or not, you know.
Well, and then there's some soil or some places they're growing a certain product that the way that they're growing that product is they kill everything in the ground, so they're sterilizing the soil.
Right.
And so everything dies. And that's how they're able to produce a certain fruit, you know, 52 weeks a year. And I don't know how that is necessarily better
than in
a greenhouse.
It's not. Exactly. That it's not, and in fact, that's very controversial. In fact, year one organic conversion. Let's say you have this beautiful ecosystem out there, and it's a forest or a riparian area, and you want to put an organic farm. You can get organic certification from year one because it was never farmed conventionally. But let's say you destroyed a whole ecosystem to put in your farm, and you didn't keep any aspect of that native ecosystem. That's very controversial right now in the organic community, and it should be, because it should be about holistic system, not just about, you know, slashing and burning and then getting the certification no matter what, you know.
Is there anything in this whole process? I want to wrap up with a couple quick questions, one for farmers, one for consumers. In this, and understanding what's going on, if a consumer that wants to support these directions, is there any way that they can shop a certain way or recognize certain production practices that if they'd say, I think this, what I've heard Pam say, makes sense and I want to go this direction, Is there anything you can advise a consumer how they can be kind of voting with their pocketbook?
It can be very confusing for consumers because there are no rules around natural. So just because it's natural, there's this consumer beware, because natural claims there's no certified standard for that. There is a certified standard for organic. So if you want a system that does not have synthetic pesticides or GMOs, then you should shop organic. The problem with non-GMO label is that, yeah, okay, there's no GMOs in it, but you can still have lots of pesticides and toxic ones with a non-GMO label. So if you really want to get away from chemical pesticides and GMOs, then organic is your label.
Yeah, well, the other confusing thing's coming is we're now changing and no one's going to be talking about GMOs. They'll be GE now.
Well, that's it, because gene editing is now, the debate is that really GMO? No, because if you're editing and not adding a foreign gene into the plant and you're just editing within it, then that should be considered non-GMO. So stay tuned. Europe has considered gene editing the same as GMO, and boy, they got flack for that.
Yeah.
Not true in the U.S., but it all depends on the consumer, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And then if you think it's tricky talking about microbes, wait till we start talking about the role of viruses.
Oh, my gosh.
And you know, flipping those switches. And so that's another whole podcast.
It is.
I tell you what, this is such an exciting area. And a lot of people are like, I am, too. It's a little confusing. It's hard to get your arms around it.
It is.
But it's exciting what you're discovering. And if anybody wants to find some additional information, is there some place that you would point them on the web?
Yes, because I actually have an educational site on our website. So our website, which is www.marone.com, I have a section on the website called BioBytes, and it's got a lot of educational information about this area on there.
Well, we need to talk about it again sometime. I think it's exciting, and there's just so much not known yet, but what we're learning is, you know, looks so promising. So, Pam, I want to thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thank you very much, Roger.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.